In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle on News Talk 760 WJR, presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne and Rochelle Riley.
We're so glad you could join us for another Sunday afternoon in the Mix, Rochelle.
And usually you and I are so chipper and excited, but in our mix today, we have to talk about what happened Wednesday with the terrible shootings of a TV reporter and photographer in Roanoke, Virginia.
Colleagues, really.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, in
fellow
our
soldiers
yep.
in the war
yep.
to bring people news. They weren't even in a dangerous neighborhood,
no.
you know, dealing with criminals. This was a former disgruntled employee of the station who decided to take someone out because he was upset about what, in his mind, were all of these things that had happened to him. So, you know, when we talk about mental illness and we talk about the abundance of guns everywhere and mm-hmm. that somebody who is just at that point where he was, who can do that and snuff out these two beautiful lives, by all accounts, it was just chilling.
Horrific. And then don't forget the social media aspect of all this. I mean, he's tweeting. He had a GoPro and was able to film this shooting. And, I mean,
posted
horrifying.
The video.
I mean,
yes,
posting the video.
Who plans a shooting and then posts it on video?
Yeah.
Someone who
yeah.
you know is just A, not well, or B, is monstrous. And we may not ever know which is true, but we've got to do something to make sure these things don't happen.
We can only hope that, you know, more and more that people will notice those around them, that if they're having a problem, that we really need to speak up for one another and for them as well,
and
for the
just,
safety of
not
all.
Not just notice, but if somebody at work, you know, okay, there's something wrong with them. Don't just walk by like, okay, that's not my problem, because it could wind up being your problem and the problem of everyone you know.
Right. And then, of course, you know how that goes. You talk to somebody else about it instead of the
yeah.
person that...
Exactly.
Well, we're glad you could join us for In the Mix today. And, Rochelle, we've got a great guest today. We're going to come back with Detroit Police Chief James Craig.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Once again, here's Marie Osborne.
More than a year after Chief James Craig, Police Chief of Detroit, spoke about the benefits of armed citizenry to fight back against criminals, well, more people appear to be arming themselves in the city of Detroit. Welcome in, Chief James Craig. Glad you could join us here on In the Mix.
Oh, how you doing?
We are all great. Can you tell us what's been the feedback for you after you came out? I know you had a lot of media attention when you made those comments about armed citizenry, but what are you hearing on the street? What are citizens telling you?
Well, you know, frankly, a lot of people from the community have applauded the fact, and we got to put it in context, for when it says arming citizens, that's not a blanket statement.
Right.
And saying, go out and get a gun.
You're talking about legal.
My conversation centered on certainly individuals when faced with an imminent threat who are, by the way, lawful CPL holders, and when faced with a threat. Now, what's interesting about the conversation, because they said, well, Chief Craig was the one that drove people to go out and get, you know, obtain permits or concealed weapons permits. That's not factual. In fact, what is factual? What we do know that in 2012, there was certainly a spike in violence in the city. In fact, the year ended with almost 400 homicides, one of the highest in recent times. And then coupled with the fact that you had a police department that wasn't responding to 911 calls. And so people felt, we're fed up. We don't have a police department responding to our emergency. So there was a decision made by so many, when certainly after the fact that Michigan became a shell issue state, people opted to obtain permits. So I come in 2013. Certainly crime was still spiking when I got here in July. And certainly we did some things. Responding to cost of service was a priority. Reducing violence was a priority. Certainly, restoring the credibility of the department was a priority. So when you look at the permits in 2012, which totaled 2,300 or 2,400 roughly, and then in 2013, more than half of those permits were issued. 2014, same number, roughly half of what was issued in 2012. And here we are this year in 2015, we're sitting on a year-to-date number of about 453. So it's not like these comments have really driven people to go out and get CPLs. The other thing I've said that I think is important to note, you know, there was some research conducted by two researchers by the name of Wright and Rossi. Those researchers pointed out that when they, I guess they researched with about 1,800 incarcerated felons, and 57% from that research stated that criminals fear armed citizens than they do the police, which I was astounded by that. But then I began to reflect back on my time in Maine and wondering why you look at Maine, relatively low violence, lots of gun ownership or CPLs, and this whole notion of criminals fearing, you know, citizens armed with guns made sense to me. And so those things, when you look at the totality, all I'm saying is we have an absolute right when faced with an imminent threat, and we are lawfully armed, that you have a right to protect yourself. Nothing more than that.
Now, we're talking with Chief James Craig of the Detroit Police Department. And the question I have, Chief, you and I have spent some time talking about the needed partnership between the community and the police and making sure that you work together. So I want to talk about what the landscape is looking like. Are people reporting crimes and throwing this don't snitch policy out the window? Are they working with you as much as they were when you first talked about how this has changed the relationship between some officers and the police, and are any of the numbers down?
I would say yes. Our relationship with the community is what I would say better than most places. I've worked in a number of cities. I'm so excited about the work that our neighborhood police officers are doing. That initiative alone, I think, certainly has paid great dividends in bridging that gap. Again, as I pointed out when I got here, the community had very little faith and confidence in this police department. And police officers, conversely, you know, the morale was down, certainly. They didn't feel supported. And so you had those two issues in play that affect how we work in the city in terms of fostering public safety and positive relationships with the community. So in terms of overall crime, you know, we are still trending in the right direction. So as of the 23rd of August, when you look at our overall violence picture, we're still down 4%. When you look at property crime, we're down 15%. And when you combine both property and violence, we're down 12%. Now, if you go back and look at where we are today and compare it to even 2013, the numbers are much larger. So we would year-to-date 2013, we're 26% down as compared to 2013. Now, I'll tell you, I'm not waving a flag of success. I'm certainly not doing that. I'm certainly saying we have made progress, and the work does continue. In terms of working with our neighborhoods, we have an external advisory board. We just had a great meeting with the LGBT community over in the Palmer Park area. Again, another effort to reach out to our community. Frankly, in most cities, the LGBT community has been underserved and been fairly silent. And so this effort certainly bridges that gap. We look at a recent meeting we had, not only with our youth, we had a youth forum this summer that was very successful, but also met with an organization that frankly didn't have a favorable opinion of the police up until recently, and that was Mothers of Murdered Children.
Oh, I'm familiar with them. Now, as you're having these meetings with real people, are you also having discussions and partnerships with some of the other security and police agencies to make Midtown and downtown safe? How are those relationships?
Working well. Well, we are about the business of collaboration. You know, when we launched CommStat after I got here, one of the tenets of that model is that we can't do this alone. I mean, we rely on our partners, whether it's on the federal side, other municipalities. Partnerships do count. We rely heavily on them. The relationship matters. And I'm excited about how we work with our partners. I just met with the Sheriff Fund, a week ago, to talk about a collaboration in working on the waterways. I mean, certainly he has a staffing challenge, as we do, but we understand the importance of making sure our waterways are safe in Detroit and the neighboring region. And so we're talking about partnerships even there.
Chief, Chief, we hate to interrupt you. I, Rochelle and I are both looking at each other and saying we need to give you a whole show, and I think we're going to work on. I think we're going to work on having that happen, because both of us have a long list of questions we haven't even gotten to, and we really enjoyed giving you an opportunity to speak your mind here. Chief Craig, thank you so much for joining us here on In the Mix.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Rochelle Riley.
Wayne County Executive Warren Evans inherited several messes, not the least of which were financial and the jail. And when you're dealing with crime outside of Detroit, which is Wayne County's responsibility, we don't seem to pay any more attention than we do to the heroic efforts he's trying to make sure that Wayne County doesn't become like Detroit. So since we're talking about violence and about renaissance and about fixing things, we asked the county executive on to talk about just that. So thank you for joining us, County Executive Warren Evans.
Well, thank you for having me, Rochelle.
Now, Marie and I want to start right with the jail.
You know, you can't help but talk about it. Everybody still talks about that jail.
It's the elephant in the middle of the city, which makes it in, you know, mm-hmm. almost in the middle of the county. So we can't help but do that, which is why we figured we'd start with that and get that out of the way and move on. So why don't we both pick on you a little bit and tell us, where are we?
Well, number one, let me just say that I have never in my life seen a more visible sign of an albatross around the neck of a county in the city like this jail has become in the last couple of years. I mean, you can think about good things going on in the county, but as soon as you come by the freeway and see that building, it just kind of just takes the wind out of your sails. So I don't think there's anything more significant to the psyche of Wayne County and Detroit than getting that thing fixed. Having said that, you know, the options we're still looking at, but I am more and more of a mind every day that the most viable option is for us to use the remaining bonds that haven't been spent and that cannot be spent for anything else and come to some closure on that existing site. It would certainly be reduced beds because there's not enough money to have the completed project, but it would hopefully create enough beds for two things to happen. One, for me to be able to close the old jail that was built in 1929 and should have been closed decades ago, number one, so we could take one of those jails out of line, and I think that's important. And the second thing is that it would allow me, if it's done right, to have a design that builds what we can afford now and allows us to build on later. So when the county is in a better fiscal position going forward, we would have the option of increasing the number of beds on that site and then closing the other jails, which was the initial idea before it became a fiasco. I know not everyone will love that idea, but the reality is when you don't have money to spend on increasing the jail and you don't have the borrowing power, but you have this albatross, you really got to look at the best ways to work with what you have and not beat up the taxpayers any more than is necessary.
Now, you mentioned that not everybody will be happy about that. I can tell you right off the bat, someone who really won't be happy about that. Dan Gilbert, who had talked several times about this, has said that that building appears right at, he called it the main streets of Detroit, you know, the two freeways that intersect, people coming into the area. The first thing, what are they going to see? They're going to see a jail. He just doesn't think that that belongs there. Is there any thought at all to just scrapping the whole project there and maybe starting over somewhere else?
Well, let's say a couple of things. I mean, one is I don't disagree with Dan Gilbert. I mean, that's not the most beautiful entryway into the city of Detroit. I had nothing to do with the initial design or the site selection. I would agree that there are better places that it could go. Now, having said that, we have $130 million in the ground over there now. To scrap the project begs an awful lot more money that we don't have. And so I'm just working with the viable options. Those who say that maybe it should go to Mound Road and that's not the right location are also not ponying up for us to complete the job somewhere else. And that's not meant to be a slap at anybody. We're in a fiscally terrible position. We're in the process of working our way out of it methodically and I think correctly. If we wait until the county's budget and finances are where they ought to be and then look at the jail, that's going to be years down the line. And I don't think this albatross needs to be hanging around all of our necks for a significant amount of time to come. So,
well, Mr. County Executive, explain it to me like I'm a six-year-old, because you're spending $17 million a year. And I'll ask you next what you could do with $17 million a year that right now is going to a hole in the ground. So if you shut it down, what would that take? What would it mean to just shut it down? And what does that cost versus $17 million a year that's being just thrown into the air?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is we have borrowed the money, we have spent the $130 million, and we're going to pay the debt service on it. The only way we get out of this thing in any semblance of a sensible resolution to me is that we are offered a significant amount of money for that site to reduce some of the money we've lost already. Again, $130 million is in the ground.
And what did Dan Gilbert offer the county?
Well, for just the jail site, $20 million. You know, people have thrown around this $50 million number, but the reality is the $50 million was for four other buildings. And so, you know, let's have an apples to apples comparison. For the jail site, the offer has been $20 million. We have $130 million in the ground. Doesn't work for me.
Okay, so I just want to ask one more question just so I can, you know, put a bow around this little piece.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say you sold it to Dan Gilbert for $20 million,
mm-hmm.
and that $17 million a year that you're paying for the debt service would have an actual end.
But it wouldn't. The debt service...
No, it wouldn't end. I'm saying, but you'd have, the end would be in sight. You know exactly what was left, as opposed to this continual just paying of $17 million a year with no other relief in sight and no selling of the building.
Well, you give me $20 million, that'll cover my debt service for 1 year. I owe the debt service for another 30 years. I mean,
So that means this is just not going to happen unless somebody is willing to give you $130 million for that site.
Let's say somebody is willing to pay the county significantly more than $20 million, and we can work in partnership with the state and some others to try to get a resolution to this thing. Again, I'm not married to any one proposal, but what I am married to is getting something done on the short term, getting more humane jails and doing it for something that the taxpayers can afford. And at this point, my initial suggestion to you is the only one I see that's viable. If there's another viable one and people are serious about coming to the table with some resources, I'm absolutely interested in hearing it. I'm not married to that site. I just think that's the only site that gets us out of this mess in the short term.
Okay, we've beat you up enough about the jail. So, Maria?
Okay, so let's talk on a good side. You were talking about the psyche of, you know, the citizenry when they see that jail. So let's talk about the psyche here. Wayne County getting a boost in its latest credit report. I was really surprised to read that, and frankly, a lot of people very happy for you on that one.
Yeah, I'm excited too.
That's
obviously
a real psyche boost, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, mine and some others. But
yeah,
I think what it is an indication that the steps we've taken over the last 8 months have been solid steps, and now with the consent agreement, the tools are there to have a balanced budget and get us out of this mess. I mean, we're not through yet. You know, I still have a number of union contracts to settle, and, you know, I would love to settle them, not wind up imposing on them. And we're working hard at trying to make that happen. And we're optimistic. But at the end of the day, we'll have a balanced budget, and Wayne County will not go to an emergency manager or bankruptcy I'm sure of that.
Well, that's music to a lot of ears, yeah. And we want to thank you again so much for spending so much time making clear what's going on and for what you're doing to fix some things that you didn't break, but that you're, you know, determined will not stay broken. We've talked with Wayne County Executive Warren Evans. Thanks so much, County Executive.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health.
Marie, I didn't know whether we had returned to the 70s or what was going on when U.S. Attorney of the Eastern District Barb McQuaid had a press conference to talk about a surge in heroin.
Right. Some trends we don't need to see a return to, and certainly heroin's one of them.
Exactly. And we're so glad to have Ms. McQuaid with us to talk about what's happening. Thank you so much for being with us on In the Mix.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about two things. One is this spike in prescription pill abuse and a resurgence of heroin addiction. But the thing that got me, particularly in reading the stories both in the Free Press and other places, is a drug trafficking pipeline to Michigan from five other Midwest states. How big is this problem?
Yeah, so what we've seen actually is the pipeline going from Michigan and into other states.
We're the culprit and sending it. Oh, wow.
We're the source state, so we're seeing prescription pills and heroin going from Michigan into Ohio, Pennsylvania, and the Appalachian states. And so it's a significant problem that law enforcement in that entire region is getting together to address.
And Barb, what one of the most insidious things when I read about this and heard about this, this starts, the addiction to heroin doesn't start as an addiction to heroin. It starts with something else, like you've had surgery, so you're on oxycodone or something of that nature, and then that's where you become addicted, and then that's what leads to the heroin. Am I right about that?
Absolutely right. You know, in recent years, the medical profession has really made pain relief a goal of medicine and a legitimate one. But it appears that they have overcorrected in the abundance of pain medication that's out there. And so as a result, people who have dental work or surgery or sports injuries take prescription pills, become addicted, and then when those prescriptions run out, it's very difficult to get your hands on that. Or if you buy it on the street, it's extremely expensive. Instead, they can get heroin for $5 a bag and continue their addiction in that way. So we're seeing that resurgence in heroin.
That is so stunning. And talking about the resurgence in heroin, heroin overdose deaths in the U.S. tripled from 2010 to 2013 and doubled in Oakland County from 2013 to 2014.
Yeah, I think one thing we're seeing is people who have never used heroin before get heroin. And when you buy something off the street, you have no idea what it is you're putting in your body. Sometimes it's laced with fentanyl, which is very potent. And oftentimes, people's first use of heroin is their last.
Wow.
Let's talk about the nuts and bolts here. I know it's nice when all of you law enforcement officials get together and have a nice sit down and a nice talk. But what real ideas? What ideas that did you come up with that you can actually implement to maybe take a bite out of this problem, Barb? What did you come up with?
Well, one specific thing was sharing information among our states. When you've got a traffic stop with drug traffickers coming down from Michigan, trying to link those cases to the traffickers we're seeing in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Kentucky. So the information sharing, data sharing that we are setting up, I think will be useful in dismantling those trafficking organizations. But another big piece of what we discussed is prevention and some really great ideas of the communities we need to educate. I think many people think it's just young people, and we have been doing some training in schools, but we've also learned that people who work with their hands and bodies, laborers, oftentimes get injured on the job. They get prescribed prescription medication and become addicted. Senior citizens who have injuries or surgeries later in life and get prescribed prescription pills become addicted. So there's no age, there's no geographic boundary for who is using, and so getting out and educating those communities is a really important part of our work.
Now, this is a huge job. You're talking about a pipeline that's going from Michigan into Ohio, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and West Virginia. Can you talk about one more specific thing that has come from this partnership, this Project Hope?
Yeah, that's the project we're going to focus on right here in Michigan. Well, we call it heroin opioid prevention and enforcement. And one of the goals that we have is as a deterrent measure to specifically target traffickers whose distribution of heroin results in an overdose death. And so yesterday we shared information with prosecutors who have prosecuted those kinds of cases to talk about the nuts and bolts of how you prove that out with coroner's reports and identifying the drug that caused death. But we think that's very important to prosecute those cases in particular in hopes of having a deterrent effect on those traffickers.
And when you talk, if we can move away then for just a moment about talking about this heroin pipeline, what about, I know you're very much into prosecuting repeat offenders and parole absconders in the county and in the region, we should say. How is that work coming along? Because I've heard from several law enforcement officials that if we really want to take a bite out of, we're talking general crime now, that we need to target these people. How's prosecution coming there?
Yeah, well, our Detroit One initiative is a joint effort among federal, state, and local law enforcement officers. And it's not just parole absconders, but a real focus on violent criminals, people who are causing violence in our community. We have to prioritize, and I think, low-level drug offenders or nonviolent offenders certainly are of concern, but we really need to prioritize our resources on people who are committing acts of violence. So we are doing a lot of work to try to identify those. And I think in a much more targeted way, we have meetings at the Detroit precinct level every week to talk about who in the community is out there and responsible for violence, and then bringing together all of those law enforcement agencies to go after them and get them off the streets.
And Barb, we talked at the top of the show about the horrible shootings in Roanoke, Virginia. Mm-hmm. These two television journalists, a reporter and a photographer, who were gunned down. And we've also talked in the past on the show about this horrible sort of uptick in child pornography and some of these folks who are doing terrible things. And one of the things that has come up is dealing with treatment versus prison, dealing with trying to get people help before they can do something horrible, either to a child or to another person. Can you talk a little bit about how that sort of dovetails with what you're trying to do with repeat violent offenders, particularly people who you got to get them off the street regardless of what happens next?
Well, for those who are violent and who have committed acts of violence, I think we need to get them off the street. But for those where maybe parents have concern about a young person who is expressing ideas of violence and has mental health issues, we want to find alternatives so that parents will have an incentive to report their child without fear of prosecution. You know, the Dearborn Police Department is a real leader on this issue and has developed a mental health intervention model. The Michigan Attorney General's Office is a leader on this with its OK to Say hotline for kids in high school who learn about people who may have suicidal tendencies or express violent ideations, a number they can call to get help for that person before it turns into some sort of mass shooting or act of violence.
That's a great idea.
But in this case, if we're talking about what happened in Virginia, Barb, there was, other than this person having had a, from what we know now, and of course we don't know everything, but from what we know, this person just had a checkered employment past and was a troublesome employee. I don't know that anybody really raised a red flag with him. I mean, there's so many people out there like that.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that we can ever stop 100% of these shootings. I think the mass shootings that we're seeing today are caused by three root causes that are very difficult to address. One is unaddressed mental health issues. The second is the abundance of guns. And the third is the internet. People are able to find like-minded individuals from somewhere around the world, and they can express ideas of violence and find someone to egg them on.
I think you've nailed it, and we are so glad that you're willing to always come on and talk with us about the hard work that you all are doing. Good luck with Project Hope, as well as with Detroit One. And I love what the Dearborn Police are trying to do. I think that if we all sort of work towards the same goal, we can do a little better about some of these things. We have been listening to Barb McQuaid, U.S. Attorney, the Eastern District of Michigan, talking about a heroin uptick and what we're going to do about it. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Attorney McQuaid.
So, Rochelle, you and I have seen this long-term change in the city of Detroit. I don't know. I'm thrilled with it. Everything that we've seen happen, and certainly Dan Gilbert has a lot to do with.
I think he has everything to do with more than a kickstart. He's doing the types of things that you had somebody to step up and do the last century with New York and Pittsburgh and other places. And while there will be plenty of people who will participate later, the fact that someone stepped up is a big deal.
Matt Cullen, President and CEO of Rock Ventures, joining us here on In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
You know, we're talking about what Detroit looks like here in 2015 and in this month, but tell us in your view and in the view of Rock Ventures, what's Detroit going to look like in 10 years?
Wow, that's a fun question to think about. I mean, I think it's going to continue. The downtown and the midtown activity are going to continue to really to expand. I mean, they're going great already, but I think it's going to be a very, very vibrant downtown. I think our riverfront is really going to explode from a residential standpoint, the Riverfront Conservancy, the work that's being done there. A lot about it will be about connectivity, right? Because with the Riverwalk, with M1, with things like that, it's really going to pull it together into a really dense and vibrant downtown and midtown. And importantly, and I think a lot of people are putting a lot of resources behind this, and certainly behind Mayor Duggan's leadership, there's going to be a real resurgence in the neighborhoods. I think we've got some work to do to sort of re-engineer it because of the significant vacant spaces that we have and so on, but I think that's already starting. I think some big initiatives are already in place to drive the neighborhoods and to create the kind of environment that people want to sort of live, work, and play and to raise their families. And the schools will be in a much better place. And I think that Detroit's going to be really a poster child in many ways for the revitalization of a great American city, one that went through this terrible bankruptcy and all of the challenges on a social and economic level and came back to be, the city that sort of changed the world as we've done in the past.
I'm glad you said that, Matt, because in the time that we've known each other over a decade and sort of looked at where things were and where things are going and what lessons can be learned, one of the lessons that has been always stunning for me is how much we have to teach ourselves while we're also teaching people outside of Detroit about what's real here and what's not. Can you talk a little bit about that cultural mindset change that you've seen go on over the past decade in Detroit and its suburbs?
Well, I think if you brought it to the suburbs, let me make two comments. Then I think that what really is our people are beginning to understand now as a region is that we sink and swim as a region, and the city of Detroit is a fundamental building block of our success as a region and ultimately as a state. When you look at what's taking place now, the younger demographic, the millennials, and so on. They want to be in an urban environment. The problem we had as a state in many instances was that people would graduate from the University of Michigan and Michigan State, and they'd get two pieces of paper, they'd get a diploma and a ticket to Chicago or something. Mm-hmm. And I think the sense that, hey, look, we can have barriers between our communities and we can be successful as, you know, sort of independent of each other, I think is flawed, and I think people recognize that. And I think that's a profound change over the last several years. We're not done yet. We got more to do in that regard, but I think it's clearly a sea change in that regard. As far as Detroiters ourselves, if you will, look, I think we had to get our own mojo back a little bit.
Mm-hmm,
we've been insolvent essentially for 20 years. I mean, but we didn't really face up to it. But it was clear and apparent from a financial and an operating standpoint. And we needed to face that up. We did that. We needed to create places where our community would come together in a way different than it had been in a long time. And I think places like the Riverfront and Campus Marshes and things, places like that where our entire community comes together and enjoys the diversity and excitement of a great urban area have been profoundly important. And now when people are seeing, hey, we're off of our financial knees and we're back in the game, and the downtown and the midtown are, you know, nearly 100% full on residential, mm-hmm. and these vibrant areas and people coming back downtown and investing and living, I think, you know, it's changing our own perception, right? Because we've been down for a long time, and it's tough when the world's telling you how bad you are, and you start to espouse the same philosophy. But recently, we have our spirit back, and I think the world is taking notice, as you can see from a lot of the, you know, what's being written and spoken about the city of Detroit these days.
Matt, if we could just talk for a couple of minutes, when we're talking about this wonderful resurgence that's happening, certainly in the Detroit area, and I dare say also in the region. But let's talk a little bit about some of the long-term. You talked about the neighborhoods and the need to develop in the neighborhoods, but also So let's talk about some of the long-term businesses that existed in the city of Detroit, the mom-and-pop shops that so many of us are familiar with and that were there through the thick and thin of it all. I had a conversation with one business owner, and I won't say who it is, but one of your developments was all around him. And I asked, I said, have they come to talk with you a little bit about what they're doing here? And he says, no, no one's ever come to me and said anything. And when I tell you, the development was right out his back door, his front door, and his two sides. So, I mean, it's everywhere for him. And I just wonder, have you listened to some of these complaints that are coming from some of these business owners? And are you doing more outreach with some of these business, these long-term business owners who really have stuck it out for the city of Detroit?
I think that there is a lot of that being done and looked at, and some very focused efforts relative to the impact of M1 and so on as to how to keep these folks in place while we go through this transition process. So I think there's a lot of it. You make a good point, I mean, though, relative to the economics. I mean, you know, as Detroit flourishes, there's going to be some changes, and we need to make sure that those are very thoughtful and that we embrace people that are being impacted upon by that change. But, I mean, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, rents in a downtown sort of converted residential unit might have been 75 cents a square foot or 80 cents a square foot. And what that happened at times was, well, you know, that really wasn't economic, and it didn't allow somebody to take care of the property. We bought properties where, you know, it wasn't up to fire code, it hadn't been approved by the Housing Commission, and all kinds of different issues. And look, the rents are now approaching $2 a square foot. Well, that has an impact on people, and we need to be cognizant of that, but it also allows us to move forward as a community and create more supply, because you can't build new and you can't do the renovation until you get to sort of an economic equilibrium, if you will. And we're still sort of a fraction of what rents are in other major metropolitan areas. But so that's fine. That's good. That's good for development. And it's great for, you know, jobs and all of the tax base and all the things that we need, by the way, in the city. But it doesn't take care of the folks that are being impacted upon. The good news is, though, that we have, you know, 138 square miles of property and some great properties that could be redeveloped and put back into productive reuse and so on. And so I think we just need to be look at it holistically and make sure that people that there's a balance as we approach these things. There's no sort of right or wrong answer. You need to balance both sides of the development and the people that are being impacted upon. And I think we have the capacity to do that, and we just need to make sure that we collectively challenge ourselves to do that every day.
Matt Cullen, we want to thank you so much for joining us here today. Another In the Mix in the books, Rochelle.
I am moved by so much that we were able to share with listeners, and we hope that they will follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/InTheMix, and we hope they'll follow us on Twitter, @InTheMixWJR.
Our thanks today to our technical director, Mark Blackwell, our producer, Laura Hess, and we hope everyone has a great week.
Absolutely, and come back next Sunday.